In some spaces.
Okay, thank you very much. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. So, this is the title of my talk. So, it's about autonomic computation in the coherent free soft spaces. So, this is Nate, and this is the institute I come from in Italy. Okay, I'll start with some background. So basically what you're gonna see right now is a sort of a sketch of the outline of my talk. Okay, so I'll talk briefly, because I'm not gonna assume you guys are all familiar with this notion, like, though I probably should not, I'm not sure anyways, I'm not gonna do that. But you know what a DFS is, and basically it's just a way of taking care of the problem of the coherence on information, is basically a symmetry aided protection of quantum information that we can use in some circumstances. For example, the prototypical one is provided by the so-called collective noise. You'll see what I'm talking about. And the second actor, the second main ingredient here, the other guy you saw in the title, is this HQC thing. So holonomic quantum computing is an old geometrical quantum information processing strategy. Okay, it's been devised a few years ago independently by a few people back in Europe. We were one of those. And one of the things that is believed to bring about is some sort of robustness, the built-in robustness against some kind of operational errors you may perform in your QIP protocols. Okay, so the first thing is a way for protecting information from the detrimental effects of the external environment, so from the coherence. And here should be something that would make your computations robust against imperfections and the control you can have over your quantum system. Okay. So the idea is that can we combine the advantages of these two approaches? Can we bring them together, so to speak, bringing together the best of two worlds? Okay, so my talk is going to be about this possibility that we have been recently addressing with the collaborators in the Toronto University. So this is basically, this talk is going to be based on a joint paper I did with Lianao Hu and Daniel Lidar. They were both at that time at the Toronto University, while now Daniel recently moved to USC. Okay, he says the weather is better there. Okay, let's start very smoothly. Okay. I'm first going to remind you guys what a quantum universal quantum computer is. So basically we have some physical system, say a multipartite physical system, a bunch of n qubits, two-level quantum systems, and this is the corresponding Hilbert space. And then you have a universal set of gates. I'm going to tell you what a universal set of gates is. Basically, is a bunch of unitary transformations acting on the global state space of the system, plus some locality conditions that are typically given by either single qubit or two qubit gates. Okay, such that whenever you perform a quantum algorithm, that the quantum algorithm here would simply mean some unitary transformation in the big space, okay, acting on some suitably prepared initial state psi n. Okay, you can basically build up this big guy here in terms of the combination of the building blocks, the basic building blocks drawn from here. So basically, what you're going to get is a so-called quantum network or a quantum circuit. Okay, that realizes or approximately realizes you as a product of these guys here drawn from the basic set of a universal quantum building. Okay, and then finally you may have to perform some measurement in the final state you obtain applying this U here over the initial state and to extract some classical information and cross-process it in order to get the answer you were looking for. Okay, so this is a fairly standard account of what universal quantum computer is. But so this is in terms of unitary transformation and gates. So unitary guys. As a physicist, we might find ourselves more comfortable talking about Hamiltonians rather than unitaries. Okay, so how this whole picture looks like at the Hamiltonian level. Okay, it's not difficult at the Hamiltonian level. What you have to have is some precise time-dependent control of the interactions that are ruling the dynamics of your system. Okay? So basically, you have a set of control parameters. Let's call them lambda. It might be, I don't know, a typical external field. You can think of external magnetic field or laser amplitudes. You have the control arm. And you basically, those are the knobs you're going to turn in order to turn on and off in order to control the dynamics and to make your system to follow the path you want it to follow. Okay, so once you get, so basically, the time dependence of the Hamiltonian is related to the time dependence of these parameters, of this external fields of the control arm. Okay. Once you do that, of course, we know what is the most general form that the quantum dynamics has, and it's just given by this form of solution of the Schrödinger equation. Okay, you have just a time order path in time integral. Okay, of this field. This is a very standard, say, textbook thing. So basically, we can say that our quantum computation is first a classical control process over these guys over here, and then that basically you're generating a path in the control manifold. The control manifold is just the manifold where the lambdas live. And associated to this path, the control manifold, you're going to have some, this formula here, you're going to have some big unitary acting on your global space. Okay, so basically from this sort of geometrical jargon that I'm introducing just because it's going to be useful in talking about the holonomic quantum computing in a few minutes, saying that you are able to enact some set of universal gates is pretty much saying that you are able to generate some basic set of paths in your control manifold. Okay, so it's all about path generation in a suitable space. Okay, so what holonomic quantum computing is basically is a restriction to a specific class of paths. I'm not going to consider the most general kind of path we were discussing so far, but I'm going to focus on a very special class. And there will be, first of all, loops. Okay, so the starting and the ending point of those paths is the same. And secondly, they're going to be, and secondly, more importantly, I should say, they are going to be adiabatic loops. Okay, so this is the setup of the game. So you have a bunch of parametric dependent Hamiltonians living in some parameter manifold, the so-called control manifold from now on. And this family has to have a crucial properties in order that the HQC game could work. So these guys here have to be isodegenerate. It means that no level crossing is going to occur while you're changing your parameters. Okay, so the spectrum, the degeneracy, the eigenvalues themselves, they can change, but you're never going to cross any of those. Okay, so you can say you can fix in a one given eigenspace. Okay, and say and this space will be rotating or will be moving in the Hilbert space, but still its dimension is going to be kept constant. Okay, so why so? Because of course I want to use the adiabatic theory. So, an example, you may want for the sake of concreteness, this isodegeneracy condition is of course a fortiori fulfilled when you consider an isospectral family of Hamiltonians. Okay, so you're basically rotating with unitaries depending on the parameters, so the dependence of the parameters now is just in these guys over here. Okay, and of course, all these guys here have the same spectrum, so in particular, these as isodegenerate family of Hamiltonians. Okay, so for each value of lambda, we can use the spectral theory. So this is nothing but the spectral decomposition. The fact that they are unitary related to each other shows up in the fact that the eigenvalue itself doesn't depend on the parameter, while the spectral projection over the Rth eigenspace depends, and this is going to be crucial, on the parameters themselves. Okay, so here is a more explicit way to write this spectral projection now. So you can introduce for each of the eigenspaces, say R. Let's, from now on, let's assume we pick that one of these R, and we're gonna discuss just of stuff lying within that eigenspace. So this is phi lambda. It is a psi sub alpha of lambda. It's just the orthonormal basis of this spectral eigenspace of the Hamiltonian. And the crucial thing here is that the lambda dependence of this orthonormal basis has to be non-trivial, where non-triviality is something I'm going to explain to you in a second. Okay. Good. Let's see. So as I said, I'm going to focus on adiabatic loops. Adiabatic loops means that I'm going to change the control parameters slowly enough that the adiabatic theorem holds true. So it means that, in particular, if I prepare my state, my initial state, in one of the eigenspaces, okay, at the end of the game, I will find myself in the same eigenspace. So if the adiabaticity is fulfilled, I'm not going to jump throughout the different spaces, right? So, by the way, this means that this scheme here is by no means universal. Because if you start in some eigenspaces, everything you're going to end up with is going to lie in the same eigenspace. Okay? So if you like, for those of you who are familiar with this notion, this HQC, this holonomic kind of computing, is yet one more instance of this encoded universality. So what I want to do, I'm going to focus on the eigenspace, and I'm going to perform, I'm going to, you know, drawing things around using holonomies. And of course, I'm not gonna couple with everything else about the stuff inside here. But the aim is that if my family of Hamiltonians is general enough, I can still be universal within the space. So in the encoding information just in that eigenspace, I'm gonna be universal with this loop. But let's cool down. So this is the loop condition. This eta over here is h bar. For some reason, it became an eta. I don't know why. And this is the usual condition, basically it's telling you that the operational time t, say, must be much bigger than the inverse of the smallest energy gap you have there. Okay, so here I'm allowing in general to have this epsilon r and s being a lambda dependent eigenvalues of my Hamiltonian. Okay, in the previous case, in the isospectral case, I've considered these guys are constant. You have just to look at the minimal gap, and you have to make sure that one would take the inverse of this, capital T, the total operational time, is going to be much greater than that. Roughly speaking, when that condition holds true, then you know that the adiabatic theorem is fulfilled, and you know that what I just told you is going to be true. So if you start from some preparation in a specific eigenspace, you're going to end up something that is in the same eigenspace. The point is that you're not going to end up with the same thing. Okay? So in front of your guide, of your initial preparation, you will typically find some unitary operator that is called the d-holonomy. Holonomy is a notion that is very familiar to differential geometry and many, many theoretical physicists, because it's basically what you get by integrating a connection form. And indeed, this connection form is exactly what is going to show up in a second here. So, you know, I'm starting from one vector, I'm changing my parameters slowly, and so these guys are adiabatically following my Hamiltonian, and even when I traverse the whole loop, at the end of the day, I'm not going to find myself in the same place, but it will be slightly displaced. It's like when you start with this, and you go down, and then you do this, and you do that, and you see something non-trivial happen. It is, of course, related to the curvature of some manifold or some fiber bundle that is there. As you well know, this stuff can be clearly formulated in the language of fiber bundles, paddling transport over a principal bundle, and that kind of stuff. I'm not going to do that right now, but of course, you can do that. So this is a very familiar formula, I guess, for most of you. So this holonomy operator is basically, now I'm no longer a time ordering operator. It might look like a minor change, but indeed, the very fact that I move from a time ordering thing to a path ordered one, it will make as far-reaching consequences, especially regarding the robustness I was talking about at the beginning, because now this object here that is just the line integral of some non-abelian connection. This is a, is a UNR valued connection, so it's a one form with value in the Lie algebra of UNR, and R is just the dimension of the eigenspace I'm working with. Okay, so and this is an entire Hermitian operator. Okay, so once you integrate this stuff here, this gets the integration of this connection form, whose explicit form is this one. So you see why I said that psi alpha had to have a non-trivial dependence, because basically this matrix element of this connection form depends on how this beta sub alpha or psi sub alpha or psi sub beta, they change when the lambda parameters are changed. Okay, this is the famous Wilczek C connection. It's one of the many contributions that Frank Wilczek gave to physics in 1984, basically soon after the discovery of the Barry phase. Okay, you all know, I guess, that this is just nothing but the non-abelian generalization of the celebrated Barry phase. Okay, because the Barry phase, you pick up just the U1 factor. And while here in general you pick up a UN factor, so a matrix, and so you're gonna generate a set of non-commuting transformations over your space. That is exactly what you would like to have in once you are looking for universality. You're not gonna get anything by an abelian set of commuting transformations. And this stuff here, these alarms, are exactly what I'm gonna use for performing quantum computing. So this is why this whole business is called holonomic quantum computing. So let's summarize. My encoding space is going to be an eigenspace of some, a degenerate eigenspace of some Hamiltonian. I change the parameters on which the Hamiltonian depends, and I'm going to generate a non-trivial holonomy map of the initial state to the other. This non-trivial holonomy that is related to the non-triviality of the curvature, basically, of this connection form, okay, the two forms shared with this one form, okay, is the set of transformations that I use. So it's my set of computations. I'm going to use quantum holonomies for performing quantum computing. So the question is, how many of those you can get in this way? Okay. How general? Are you going to be universal, as I promised? Okay, in general, of course, that won't be the case. You will be universal just if and only if some condition will be fulfilled. The nice thing is that those conditions turn out to be pretty generic ones, okay? So the set of things you can get in this way, so if you like a set of computations that can be enacted using this kind of trick, the adiabatic loops, is known to have a structure of a group that is known to be is nothing but, of course, the holonomy group of this connection here. Okay. Once you have the Hamiltonian family, you can compute the Wilczek connection, and then in principle, you are in the position of computing this guy here. And then you can ask yourself whether these guys is just a strict subgroup of all possible unitary transformations over your space, or is the full thing. Okay. So if this last is the case, if this latter is the case, then you know that you can perform exactly any arbitrary transformation over your coding space using holonomous hull. Okay? And this is exactly what you can do when the connection allows for a maximal holonomy group. And those connections are termed irreducible connections that are known in turn to be the generative case. Okay? So this is pretty much the crash course on holonomic quantum computation. So do you guys have questions on this part? Because I'm going to switch to the other actor, to the other ingredient, that is the DFS, that you might be more familiar with or less, or I don't know.
What's P again?
What's that? P is very important. Thank you, Lee. P is the path ordering. Because, okay, this is a bit of an abstract, say, informal thing, of course. You have to expand this in the basically, you have to expand exponentially to take the proper ordering of the operators. And pretty much like we did in the general time-dependent solution of the Schrödinger equation, you have to make sure that those operators, say the Hamiltonians there, or the connections here, they will show up in the right order. So they're following, so you have a path, the path is an oriented one, so you have a natural order of it, and this string of operators showing once, showing up in the expansions of the exponential here, they have to be ordered according that orientation. Okay, so is that clear? It's ordering operators. The sooner they the point shows up in the curve, the probably the right most has to be the corresponding operator as well. Okay. And this is important because it tells you that this is geometrical. Okay, geometrical. It doesn't matter as long as this formula holds true. So as long as the adiabatic theorem is fulfilled, no matter how slow you go, okay, or how fast you go. Okay, you're gonna get the same thing. It doesn't depend on timing anymore. So this is really telling you that you know there, you sort of got one more degree of freedom. Because in standard dynamical gates, in order to make sure, for example, that you realize a sigma x or a pi cos, you have to make sure that your timing is correct. Because otherwise, you will end up either too early or too late. Okay, you want to hit the state you wanted to hit. But here, I mean, it's just basically some global geometrical feature. Also, pretty much, I mean, if you want, when you have a non-degenerate eigenspace, this will give you back the very phase. And the very phase, meaning we all know, depends just on the area you span in this control space, say when you have this moving, adiabatically moving, magnetic field around. And at the end of the day, you complete the thing, and your quantum state will pick up a phase that is proportional to the area you spend in your circuit, right? So the matrix elements of this holonomy sphere, basically, they have a built-in geometrical properties, okay? They will typically depend just on geometrical properties, pretty quite open, say, areas in some suitable control space. Okay, and so as long as you don't change the area, you're basically allowed to change other features. So it depends just on global geometrical feature of your control process. You have a classical control process is driving the lambda around. As long as you keep the area swept by this path constant, you're not going to change the result of your dynamical evolution. Okay, and this is at the very basis of what has been admittedly waving the hands for most of the time, the robustness of this kind of approach. Being dependent just on geometry and being likely that most of the perturbation one could find, the most of the perturbation that might occur in the system, they will keep the area, there will be like fluctuation that will cancel, basically the effect on the global area. So basically, most of the perturbation will keep area constants, and accordingly, they will keep the holonomics constant.
Yeah, in the case of the very phase, there's also just the sort of dynamical phase of the e to the minus I et.
Absolutely.
You have that here too, but I guess you're better off here because you have a higher dimensional subspace. So
look,
there's a lot of information that's insensitive to the dynamical.
It's insensitive, phase. Yeah. Of course, as Rafael is pointing out, I have a global dynamical phase here as well. Okay, but since I'm going to perform all my computations, I'm going to stick just on states living in the eigenspace. This is just a global one, okay? So I can safely forget about it. But if I would run, say, in parallel, holonomic quantum computation on different eigenspaces, I would have to take into account even the relative difference in dynamical phases, okay? Actually, some of the approaches. So holonomic quantum computing is an instance of this geometrical quantum computing. In some of those techniques, people had to take explicitly into account the fact that you still have around dynamical phases. And for example, getting rid of them by using some refocusing scheme or symmetrization schemes. So there might be a problem with those. Okay. Here in holonomic, there's not, because everything is happening in the general time space. So the dynamical phase is just going to be a global one.
What is mu index here? Is it just different control parameters?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any other questions here? We're going to switch to the next topic. The next character, the second main character. Let's see what it's called. Quantum error correction and avoidance. Okay. Actually, I don't want to correct errors here. I want to take a more passive attitude. I want to just avoid them. Okay. And in order to do that, I need the help. And I mean, the power would help. Those errors are very, I mean, are everywhere out there, and they're very pernicious. And the most, you know, what is the most helpful thing that we theoretical physicists have been with over all our life? Of course, it's symmetry. Okay, so not surprisingly, once again, symmetry is going to help us in this business. Okay, and this business now is called error avoidance. So, but before avoiding error, let me tell you. I mean, I don't know. Of course, here we have big experts, extremely big experts, but maybe some of you still might find helpful what I'm going to say. So I'm going to define an error avoiding code in terms of an error correcting code, nevertheless. Okay? So a code, so once again, I have a physical space, a physical system whose Fermi space is going to be called H. Okay? And then I want to encode information. Encoding is always like encoding in a subspace, in a linear subspace of the global hyperspace. Okay? So this is C is going to be my code, nothing but a linear subspace of the global hyperspace. Okay? And then I have two other guys. One is the bad guy, because this here is the noise process. Okay? So basically it's the decoherence that is induced by the unavoidable coupling that every system has with its environment. Regardless how small this could be, on the long run, and we want to run very long computations in order to take advantage of the quantum information things, because they react better in the asymptotic limit, of course. So the errors will add up, and so you can't neglect the coherence anymore. So you have to face this fact that despite we would love to have just unitary transformations, coherent manipulations for doing QIP, the real process is going to be described by a different kind of object that in general will be like a completely positive map. Okay, this is just a decoherence. Okay, but if you are smart enough and you can devise the proper C, then it exists another kind of transformation. This is the called recovery operation. So basically, what is this? Error correcting code is a subspace such that for the given noise process N, it exists a recovery operation that basically allows us to invert the general irreversible action of the environment and to restore the initial information. Okay, so you have this couple here, if you like, the error correcting code is a term by C and R, that is a good quantum error correcting code for N, if for every state supported in the code, you can invert the action of the noise. See, so basically this is telling you that R, that is once again a completely positive map, inverts or reverse the action of the noise, and you can restore the original information. This is one of the possible definitions of one of the possible characterization of the quantum code that I think that is physically pretty transparent. Okay? Of course, this basically comprises what is known like syndrome extraction, and then you have to restore, you extract the syndrome, you basically measure your system in order to know, to understand what went wrong, and then on the basis of that, you perform some, say, unitary actions of your system. You rotate back the system to the proper uncorrupted codebook, okay? But let me be very schematic here. So what is a decoherence-free subspace? Or an error avoiding code, as you may want to call it, is nothing but an error correcting code where the recovery operation is very simple, just do nothing. Okay? So you don't have to recover an operation. So basically, you can plug in this expression to your identity, and you will find what the DFS is. Okay, well, as I said at the beginning, the prototype case for this is this collective decoherence. Well, what do I mean by that? I mean, you have a bunch of spins, and they are interacting with some environment, and say a bunch of bosonic modes, say photons or phonons. But those photons, for example, they are very large wavelengths, so they cannot really discriminate the internal structure of your quantum register. So all the qubits are affected in the same way, okay, by this time. So this is why I termed that collective. So in general, we can describe the noise process being in a completely positive map, we can describe it this way. For example, as a completely positive, as a cross operators, a cross representation of this completely positive map. The collective nature I just described in this noise process reflects itself in the fact that these Krauss operators are totally symmetric operators. What does it mean? It means that, of course, they commute with all the permutations, where these guys here are element of the permutation group, of the symmetric group, M, S, M, and they're just swapping the different qubits, okay? If the interaction with the environment is symmetric, and the environment is not able to tell who's who, it means that everything can appear here half to satisfy this equation here. It has to be symmetric, because all the qubits have to be treated on the same footing, right? If this is the case, it's a simple exercise in SU2 representation theory, by now very standard, okay, to see that the following linear subspace that is nothing but the singlet sector of the collective SU2 representation, so it's the set of states in H that are invariant under the action or under the collective action of SU2. So they are the rotationally, the collective rotationally invariant states, the singlets. Okay, these guys here are exactly an example of this. So the noise acting on this just gives back the state uncorrupted, okay, without the need of any recovery operation. Okay, so this is the coherence. This is the coherence grid. Okay, for example, if you bunch together four spins, you can check, going through the elementary exercise, that you will find a couple of qubits there, a couple of singlets that might be used for encoding one noiseless qubit. Okay, this is the original example we discussed back in the 1970s with Meyer as a, okay? This is all about the DFS. Questions about the DFS, because now we're gonna bring together the HQC and the DFS. Everything clear? Everything completely obscure? No, I guess it is not. Okay, so as I said, the idea is that to use, so of course, this stuff here is immune to the coherence, and the very reason for that is the symmetry. Okay? And on the other hand, the Lanowni computing, I tried to argue that in view of the geometrical nature of the ingredients showing up there, should be kind of robust, and this has been proven. At least in some systems, there is a growing a body of evidence that this was indeed the case, that at least for some geometrical quantum computing, you can take advantage of this geometrical nature, so you have some robustness, okay? Now we want to bring the two things together. I want to get rid of the coherence, so the bad things due to the environment, put something in my DFS. And then I want to drag things around. I want to perform manipulations within the substance, within this DFS, using just geometrical means. Okay. In this case, in principle, I should be bringing together robustness against the coherence and robustness against operational errors, and that would be kind of ideal. And if I could do that even in a way that is experimentally realizable, it would be just great. Okay. For the time being, I'll do just on the board. Okay, then I'll try to argue that we may be not too far from experiments as well. Okay, so now I'm going to consider a simpler kind of decoherence-free substrate. Because the singlets I was talking about right now, they are immune to decoherence in the case of a general collective decoherence, where all possible flips and phase flips are occurring to your cube. Okay. But there are situations, experimentally relevant situations, in which the main source of noise is known to be just pure phase, so just phase flips are occurring. They're not just, I mean, mostly phase flips, okay? So you may could take care of the dominant source of noise, just encoding information in a DFS that is robust against that specific kind of noise. And that space is easier than the singlet sector I was talking about, let's say. Okay, let's see which kind of decoherence subspaces we're going to play from now on, okay? So I'll consider just a very simple system, four qubits, okay? Four spin one-up particles. And this is my DFS, okay? It's just the DFS in which you have just one of those spin excited. So it can be either in the first, either in the second, or in the third, or the fourth. Okay? That's it. This is the eigenspace of the global sigma z or z operator. And this guy here is a DFS. It's very easy to be checked out when the interaction with the environment is going to be this. So HSP means the interaction between the system and the bath. Okay? And this is any, doesn't really matter what this be here. It's just one bath operator. Okay, and this is the global. This is the global sigmas. Okay, this is Z1, Z2, Z3, and Z4. They're just denoting, of course, the sigma Z guys acting here on the in the first or the second or the third or the fourth. Okay, is this clear? So this is the global magnetization along the Z axis, you may want to call it. If this is the case, so if the interaction is at least approximately described by this Hamiltonian over here, you know that this subspace here has the properties a good DFS has to have. And so it's robust against collecting the phase. So you might think that this is an extremely simple example, maybe, you know, just a very academic one. That's turned out not to be the case. Because actually, for example, in ion traps, people discover that this global, this collective, the phasing is responsible for most of the decoherence in ion traps, or at least in some kind of ion traps. And so by using this encoding, they were able to reduce the decoherence rate in the system of several orders of magnitude. Okay? So improving the fidelity of their storage, of their memory, by several orders of magnitude. So this is, I guess, a Nature or Science paper back in 2000. Okay, and it has been demonstrated in the lab and in other experiments. So as simple as it is, still it might have some relevance for, you know, for serious people doing things in the lab. Okay, now that I told you what the DFS is, I guess I have to tell you what the holonomic operators, the kind of controls I'm going to use for performing my analysis. Let's assume the dynamics of the system is generated by the following Hamilton. Okay? I'm going to tell you in a sec what they did. So the J's are coupling constants, which are supposed to be the my knobs. They're going to play the role of the lambdas you have seen in the general introduction to HQC. So these are the guys I'm going to change in time, probably changing in time in order to enact the non-trivial dynamics. While Rx and Ry, the indices M and L, M, L, are just labeling the different qubits, okay? Okay, these are the guys. Okay, so these are Rx, this is Ry, and this is Rc. And these are the usual sigma X, sigma Y, and sigma Z operators acting on the L and the qubit. Okay, it's not difficult to check that these guys here, they provide a faithful representation of SU2 once you restrict yourself to the state 0, 1, and 1, 0 in the L and the M for qubit. Okay, and they, of course, both commute with the global state, with the global Z component of state. So they're going to leave unchanged, they're going to leave invariant all the eigenspaces of this latter operator. And in particular, they're going to leave unchanged my DFS, okay? Being the DFS, nothing but an eigenspace of the collective spin Z operator, right? So if I can control this kind, if I have this kind of Hamiltonian, I'm sure that if I start inside DFS, I'm not going to leave it, okay? So it's invariant. The DFS is invariant under these guys. Okay, so these guys are controlling this parameter. From now on, I'm basically just explaining to you with some details you might be interested in how to perform a universal set of holonomic gate inside this DFS. Okay, using these guys here. Of course, at the end of the day, the real question would be whether this kind of Hamiltonian can be implemented in some meaningful and interesting system. Okay, and the answer might be that we are not that far from that. I'll be briefly commenting upon before the end of my talk. Okay, look this. Now I'm going to focus on three qubits called respectively L, M, and N. And assume that you have this time, I mean, all the calculations I'm going to show you are very simple. You may not be able to follow them instantaneously, but if you sit down and with a backup envelope, you can do that very easily. Okay, so I'll be pretty fast, but it's very easy to check what I'm saying. Okay, very, very easy. And all this comes after a very nice proposal made back in 2001 by Lu Mingguan, Ignacio Sirac and Zoller. They proposed how to realize holonomic quantum computing using ion traps, once again. And basically, what was very nice about that proposal was not just the fact that it was experimentally feasible, even though it has not been realized so far, okay? So maybe it was feasible, but not that easy. But the fact is that the abstract level structure they introduced, this dark state that everybody in quantum optics is familiar with, is something that you can just take and apply verbatim in many other circumstances. That is basically what we did even here today. Okay. So when you have this anatomia here, it's not difficult to check that just these three states are involved. Say this is where one is in the alpha qubit, the excitation is in the alpha qubit. This is where is in the F qubit, and this is where is in the F qubit. Okay. You can check that this state here, okay, is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Is a one-line calculation, even less than that, such that the corresponding eigenvalue is zero. Is a so-called dark state. For some reason, in quantum optics, these kind of states show up all the time, and they're known as dark state. Okay, so you may find useful this. So it's a so-called lambda configuration. Look, so these are the state, both, and this. So when I turn on the coupling J and L, basically I'm taking the excitation from the nth place to the L place. While when I turn on J and L, I'm taking the excitation from the nth place to the L place. So basically, the couplings showing up in my Hamiltonian, they're realizing this coupling scheme between these different levels. But now each of the levels is a three-qubit state. Okay, and here is again the dark state. You can easily generalize this, and you can consider, say, generalized lambda configuration, say, with many legs. The idea is always that on top you have one state, and the bottom you have a sequence of states that are coupled, turning on the different terms in the Hamiltonian to the upper one. Okay, and this will result in some bunch of dark states. So you can generalize this construction here. For example, we can go to the four qubit altogether. Now you know what the trick is. J24 moves the interaction from the excitation from the second place to the fourth place. J14 from the first to fourth, and J34 to the third to the fourth. Okay. In this case, when you have three elements, three states at the ground level, at the bottom level of this lambda scheme, it turns out that you have a couple of dark states. In general, the thing goes, if you have n guys at the bottom level, coupled with one guy at the top level, you're going to get n minus one dark states. And that's great. This is exactly the degenerate eigenspace I needed for holonomic quantum computing. Because now, this eigenvalue equation, what is remarkable here, is this doesn't depend on J. Okay, the state itself depends on J in the non-trivial fashion I needed, as I'll show for performing the anomalies. Okay, but it doesn't depend. And this is remarkable because, well, suppose you have a zero eigenstate of Hamiltonian, as soon as you change the parameters of this Hamiltonian, so you perturb the Hamiltonian, you're gonna basically change the eigenvalue and you're gonna split the degeneracy, right? This is what we typically, the generic cases, any small perturbation in Hamiltonian will result in brain lifting degeneracy. This doesn't happen here. It doesn't happen. For all the time, you have this family of gate of Hamiltonians, and nevertheless, the degeneracy is constant. So I got that isodegenerate family of Hamiltonians I talked about at the beginning, right? And now on, from now on, I just technicalities. So first, let's realize what cubical anomic is. I will need a couple of those, a couple of non-commuting one qubit gates in order to realize the universal set of single qubit gates, and then forget the real universality I will have to have on top of those. I will, this is the two qubit operation. And I'll show you how to do that by using this kind of tricks involving the degenerate dark state manifold. So the idea is that I have the big DFS. Inside that, I have a dark state manifold. Okay, it is a degenerate, lambda-dependent eigenspace of this family of Hamiltonians. And I'm going to modify, dramatically changing the parameters of those Hamiltonians in order to induce non-trivial anomalies in the space. All the time within the DFS. And look, that's great. Because one of the major objections that you may raise against holonomic quantum computing being an adiabatic scheme is that it's low. And we know that the coherence solved there is strong, and you better be fast, okay? But in this case, basically the coherence is no longer there. We first took care of the coherence by putting everything in the nice corner in the Hilbert space named the coherence-free subspace. And now we can be as low as we want, so we can be as adiabatic as required, okay? And not creating full advantage of the robustness against stochastic control errors that I have in my holonomic case. Let's see what's going on here. And then the other tricks will be pretty much the same, okay? So suppose I turn on, so I have assumed, and this might be a major experimental part of it, that I have full control over my Jx and Jy parameters, right? So I can certainly design the parameters to take this form here, okay? So basically, this Hamiltonian has a non-trivial action just in these three states, where the excitation is either in the fourth, or in the third, or in the second, okay? While where the excitation is in the first, it's completely decoupled, okay? Because you see here, I have 2 and 4, and 3 and 4, okay? And now I'm going to tell you what my logical 0 and 1 qubit states are. So 0L is given by the logical 0 is going to be given by this guy here, where the excitation is in the first qubit, while the logical 1 is given by 0010, where the excitation is residing in the second qubit. Okay? So we know by now that this is the dark state, and you see what is defined. In this dark state, just the logical one is showing up. While there is another state that is outside of the computational space that is going to be used just as auxiliary space, an auxiliary state. Because now what I'm going to do, this is pretty much like the spin one-half particle in an external magnetic field, very first considered. And so now if you change the adiabatic, say, phi and theta. So theta is like the latitude, and the phi is like the latitude. And so you can go through some loop in this parameter that you are controlling by assumption. At the end of the day, what happens is very easy. It's pretty much the same exercise you have to go through when you check the original Berry thing. Okay, you will get the following thing. That 0 won't get any phase, or if you like, this is just the relative. Okay, 0 won't get any phase because 0 is completely decoupled by this game, okay, by the very definition of the encoding scheme. And here, basically, you've been going around like at the very case, and at the end of the day, you go back to this state here. Even this will pick up a phase, of course, it will be opposite sign of this, but it doesn't really matter. Now, what you want to look is just to check what happened in the computational space. And this is what happened there. So the one picked up the phase. So this is basically a phase shift. It's a sigma c operation is encoded sigma c operation in the computational space. Okay. So I just showed you how to realize by anomalies by a very phase, in this case, a sigma c operation on the computational space. Of course, that's not going to be enough. I need at least one more non-commuting single qubit operation in order to span the full set of operations. Now the algebra gets a lot more complicated, but still something that you may want to, you could check and a few lines of calculations. So I ask you, believe me, you can, again, you set the parameters in order that your Hamiltonian looks this way, and now you can check, for example, that this state here, you consider the symmetric and anti-symmetric combination of the logical zero and the logical one. So the symmetric combination is annihilated by this, and so from this, it turns out that the dark state of this new Hamiltonian I design is given by this, okay? So you can go through once again the same trick. You move in the phi theta space, an adiabatic loop, you go on to this adiabatic loop, at the end of the day, just the state minus will pick up a phase, pretty much as the one did the slide before. Good, so this is what happens. And of course, this new gate is like a conditional phase, it's like a phase shift in the new plus minus basis that, of course, once you go back to the computational basis of the following four, that really tell us that this in general will be a commuting non-commuting operator with the previous one. Okay, so far I've shown you how to perform a couple of non-commuting single qubit operations. What I'm left with is quite challenging still, is how to perform a non-trivial two qubit operation. Okay. Let's see how you can do that. The trick is going to be pretty much the same, but if you go Hamiltonian, of course, now it's more complicated. Let's assume, and I ask you to believe me for the time being, that you can engineer some effective four-body interaction, okay? Because, of course, each of these qubits now, it involves a two-body. Single qubit operation will involve single qubit logical operations were involved in two body physical operation. So this two logical qubit operation is going to involve four qubits, four physical qubit interaction. Assume that you can do that. Okay, you can engineer this thing here. It looks complicated, but if you rest a second and you look at it carefully, you will see that it's just the natural thing one could think of bringing together the former stuff. Okay, this is a four body interaction with this form. Again, by now you know what the trick is. You can check it out. You have a dark state that is given, this is just like two copies of the logical one plus two copies of an auxiliary state, okay? You can plot this guy here, and not surprisingly, you will see, basically, this is just a product of the two of the former Hamiltonians, okay? So this is the dark state. You go through the usual thing. You adiabatically change the parameters, and then what you get is the following operation. This is the truth table of the operation you get. And not surprisingly, all the other logical states that were completely decoupled from by this Hamiltonian here, the only state that is really involved with no trivial dynamics is the long one. Okay? And so this is what happens. It's just this guy that will pick up a phase here. And so, of course, this is the truth table of the control phase shift that we all know, along with the single qubit operations, are already shown you. This is going to provide a universal set of gates. This, okay? So basically, I'm pretty much done here. So, because I told you how using just adiabatic manipulations, all of that constrained in a DFS, how to realize a universal set of gates. Of course, you may ask about generalization of this. So this is all about, so far, everything was all about the collective defacing subspace. Okay, can you do something like this in more general circumstances? For example, can you do something like this for general collective decoherence? We have some partial answers to that. But before that, you might ask whether this scheme is scalable. Okay, because I showed everything for two qubits. Of course it is. Okay, you can bunch together different sets of four qubits, and then if you assume that you can switch it on and off all the interaction I have shown you for arbitrary pairs I and j, of course you can enact all kind of single qubit gates to me in a very simple way. So of course for scaling the thing, so if you have n copies of those four qubits, then this is still a collective DFS against collective defacing, and just basically the construction What you really have to generalize here is just two cubic construction, okay? And so just you can check it by just by generalizing this, moving from this kind of coefficient where those showing up in the two cubic Hamiltonian, this more general one, you will get the desired control phase shift between arbitrary pairs I and J. Okay, that's trivial. And that's a little bit, I would say, far less trivial is the case of general collective coherence. So I'm almost over, right? Who's the chair? Get it?
Yes. Sorry, I was asleep.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just really. Well, we should leave a little time for questions. So if you
okay,
finish in 5 minutes.
You know, it's no problem. This is the last one slide. No. Okay, well, let's hurry up. So you may be familiar or not, and if you're not, you're not gonna become today with the notion of Neisman subsystem. Okay, it's a generalization. Actually, it's a true generalization of the notion of the coherence free subspace that was being introduced back in the 2000 by Manning, Neil, Ray, Laflamme, and Lorenzo Viola. Okay, which you are now looking to a subspace of the Hilbert space that allows you to recover errors without actually doing nothing. But you have to look in a more subtle way to some virtual factors, virtual subsystems in your space. So for example, if you consider 5 spin 1-up particles, this is just the usual catchword and the composition of the global Hilbert space into irreducibles of SU2. Okay, so in particular, you have 1 spin 5/2 representation with multiplicity 1. This is a totally symmetric one. Then you have 5 copies of the spin 1/2 representation. And then in particular, you have 4 copies of the spin 3/2 representation of SC2. Okay? The idea of Neisler subsystem that you can encode information, and that information is going to be immune from the coherence, from collecting the coherence here, okay, in these factors over here. I ask you to believe me now, okay? If you put stuff in these factors somehow, this is going to be totally decoupled from the coherence. It's noiseless, while with the other factors are noiseless, full problem. And why I'm considering here just 5 qubits, just because here at the 4 available states here, okay? And so if I have 4 available states, in principle, again, I can go through all the calculations and all the tricks I've been playing before, right? What I needed at most were 4 guys and the possibility of coupling them according to some generalized lambda scheme, okay? So once I have these 4 levels, now the goal is to couple them in the proper way that will allow me to go through the very same things I did. Can you do that? Okay, now I have just an existential answer, existential yet positive answer. Yes, in principle, you can do that. Because we know that in order to enact universal manipulations here in these factors over here. So basically, these are the collective SU2 representations, while this guy here, the multiplicity factors, are just the irreducible representation of the commutant of this algebra, so are the permutations. Irreducible representation of the permutation group. And in order to be universal in an irreducible representation of the permutation group, it's enough. And so in particular, in order to be able to enact those, to realize those lambda schemes that I need for playing my adiabatic holonomic trick, I can be universal in those just by controlling Heisenberg's change interaction. So if you can turn on and off a twill between arbitrary pairs in your quantum register, this kind of transformation, at least in principle, you can reach any unitary transformation in that space. Okay? This is an encoded universality. So Heisenberg interaction is going to be encoded universal when you restrict yourself to invariant to the irreducible representation space of the permutation group. This is a result I worked out with the set Floyd some time ago. So in principle, if you can do that, at least at the existential level, you can build up those lambda schemes even here, and so you can perform holonomic computing in a Neisler subsystem, rather than in an isolated substrate. Of course, you could do that within an isolated substrate, but you know, then you would, for getting four qubits, four isolated qubits, you would need to consider a larger number of spins. Okay, so I'm saying for getting four singlets, of course, I think I need at least six qubits. Okay, for with six qubits, is that right? I think so. Okay, with six qubits, I would probably get a four-dimensional, or maybe even bigger, singlet sector, and then I could play the three. So for saving space, in order to have an optimal realization of that, I had to move to this more general notion of nozzle subsystem, and plus the observation that can be universal just by switching on and off this kind of stuff. Okay, so this is the last one slide that I just let it. I think we can start. So this stuff can be, I'll be very, very quick here, you know? This kind of anatomies, they can be actually real. There are some hope that will be realizable soon in the lab. For example, in spin base, when you encode information in the spin of an excess electron in a quantum dot, so I'm here referring to the last leading chance of proposal, okay? This, and when you take into account the spin orbit coupling, this is the effective interaction you get between the pairs of spin. And you have these coupling constants here that, of course, are related to the J's I showed at the beginning. And you have some hope to control this stuff by working on the shape of the confining potential, by doing some pulse shaping. And this stuff, at least part of it, has been already demonstrated in the lab. These are a couple of papers of references where people have been experimentally doing that, controlling these parameters that are related to the spin orbit coupling. So there is some chance to realize at least the HX and HZ Hamiltonian I use in order to enact the two qubit gates, the single qubit gates. And even, as surprising as it might seem, there are chances, the same is true in other traps for the single qubit Hamiltonians I've used. By using the so-called Sorensen-Milner scheme, okay, that it involves the use of two lasers, the control of two lasers, okay, and this stuff has been realized in 2002 in this paper. So no problems for realizing that kind of Hamiltonians in the ion trap proposal. But even H4, as strange as it might seem, can be realized basically generalizing this Sorensen-Milner scheme acting on two different pairs of ions, okay? So H4 can be realized as well, so we have the chance and the hope that even the two-qubit holonomic control in this DFS might be enacted, might be realized in this kind of systems. That, by the way, have been already, in IonTrap, some sort of geometrical gain has been already demonstrated. So from this point of view, I would say that the ion trap are the most promising implementation system that might be seeing the implementation of the kind of tricks I've been talking to you today. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention. For those of you that are willing to know more, most perverse people, you can have a look to this to this paper here. Okay, recently appeared in the Physical Dynamics. Then, please.
So, what happens if you get some kind of perturbation that's not part of your control?
You mean something taking me out of the
exactly
of the DFS?
So, how do you get that?
You don't get that. I mean, look, this is the point. I mean, you are not correct. You would need some error correction. So
So obviously I'm not necessarily expecting you to get back to exactly the same state, but you should be able to get back, you would want to get back to something, to some kind of state. That's
so there are two kinds of perturbations. Those that are taking you out of the DFS, and then you are skewed. But the point is that this kind of stuff, I mean, DFSs are nice, not just because ideally they take care of all the decoherence. When there is some symmetry breaking, say some perturbation of those that will take you out of the DFS, still you can show that this stuff is pretty robust. I mean, the leakage probability or the fidelity is going to be affected like second order thing. So this is a robustness of the DFS, okay? violation of the symmetry completion of the finding, the DFS still would result in a higher order effect. So this is so you wouldn't be skewed by the probability of being of getting that kind of problem. I think it is pretty small if you're really taking into account the dominant source of the coherence by the DFS. If you have a perturbation inside the DFS, this is exactly the thing that the holonomic control is supposed to. So if you have some flat, for example, you are driving those theta and phi that are basically amplitude as well as phases of your laser, okay, and you have some bumps, some stochastic fluctuation of those that would result in operational effect. This is exactly what on the other hand, HQC should take care of. So bump errors are present, but the whole point is that they should be much more unlikely.
Well, okay, so I'm worried about the ones that take you outside.
When you're taken outside, I don't think you're out of the DFS.
Well,
so do you have some idea? I don't say that this would spoil me, but still the whole point is that the probability that happens is very small.
Well, but what do you mean by small? I mean, how small are we talking?
It's, if you have some Hamiltonian, say. Depending on some parameter, and then you have this for some lambda zero, this is the correction of Hamiltonian satisfying all the symmetries. Okay, and so the DFS would be taking care perfectly of the coherence. And now you slightly perturb this Hamiltonian, so you basically put some, for example, not collective terms, that is order delta. Okay, for example, you can check, I think it's the fidelity, we should go back to the papers where this is shown, but basically, fidelity is no longer 1, but it's like delta square, maybe over delta 4. So it's higher order in this sense.
Well,
so it might be not smaller, depending on the strength of the
well, delta. Exactly. That's my question. Is it like, say, in the ion trap, and what kind of delta can you expect?
Okay, in the ion trap, look, exactly, that's a good point. In the ion trap, as I said, they found that this collective phasing the thing is the dominant source. So dominant, it's not, you're not taking care of everything using just the DFS. But as I said, so rather than, so for example, we were plotting fidelity as a function, so this is 1. And they were really done, so you would expect something exponential, and they were really finding something like this. So they were strongly reducing this. Several orders of magnitude, I would say. They were moving from a fidelity after a typical time, I don't know, from 0.3, okay, set some check time here to 0.99999. Okay, I can't go really much faded on this. But once the collective character of your bars has been assessed, you can be pretty effective on this. And of course, it's telling you that the thing is robust. Because not all the noises, so you still have some symmetry breaking terms here, okay? But still, you can have some pretty robust encoding there.
Okay, you think that it's like 10 to the minus 4 or less?
Ooh, ah, you're really asking me figures.
Well,
we should work out in some area.
Let me explain why I'm concerned about this. So. Obviously, if you're just doing something with 2 or 3 qubits and you just want to do 5 gates, then maybe this is negligible, you can ignore it. But if you really want to build a quantum computer, you have to do much longer things.
Yeah.
Yeah, if there's a type of error that's going to totally kill you, you can't have it happen at all. Right?
I understand
it,
yeah.
So if you're doing 1,000 gates and the error is 10 to the minus 4, well, it starts to become significant.
Yeah, you get 5 gates. It might be a problem. But look, honestly, if you ask me, I mostly regard the thing like, you know, a goal for, it's not going to be the final answer today to the quantum computer thing. It might set a goal for some intermediate realization, as I think there would be a lot of good physics and nice experiments you can perform trying to implement these kind of ideas. And you might take actual advantage in some probably small or medium scale quantum computing, though if you would ask me if I really believe this is going to be the final answer, I understand this. You must really make absolutely sure that the errors that are going to kill you, they won't ever show up. and I don't know whether this is the case. But I think really that for small, medium-sized processor, you could really perform much longer computations getting rid of the decoherence by the DFS encoding and taking advantage of the robustness of the geometric allocation. But this is going to be the answer, and I don't think it is the case. And anyways, it should be checked case by case, I think. Really, give me Hamiltonian. Let's see. Here I was assuming that my, I was assuming basically that my the coherence was the collective one. And in that case, I know by the theory that I can take care of it, I can get rid of it just by this encoding. But in a realistic situation, we should carefully look at the numbers to see how things are doing. That's for sure. Please.
So for scalable quantum computing, the problem is you can only do 1 over delta squared operations, which is better than 1 over delta operations. Mm-hmm. But is it, can't you just take this and now plug it into more traditional quantum error correction? Except now where your errors are much, much, maybe delta was too big, but delta squared is below the fault tolerance threshold.
I will say yes.
Isn't that the idea?
Okay, so first of all, delta wasn't even the right parameter. It was lambda that was the right parameter, because the symmetric decoherence was an error before you started the DFS. But second of all, this was part of what my question was, is that if you leave the decoherence-free subspace and have no way of getting back to it, then it's hard to apply error correction because you're getting into some bigger Hilbert space that the error correcting code is not designed for. If you can get back, then it's just an error.
The idea has been from the very beginning, if you go back to the say original first papers on DFS, that we were quite aware that you couldn't really solve the whole thing in this way. So people like myself, Daniel, Yara, other, we always been kind of wondering whether you should embed, for example, in the next layer, you first take care of some of the noise with the DFS, you reduce the strength, and then use this logically DFS encoded qubits, and you bring them together to build up the error correction code. The next layer, how do you call it, nesting?
Concatenation.
So concatenating DFS.
That's fine, but you have to be sure that the error model that comes out of the DFS is still something you can correct.
Absolutely.
Using the error.
Absolutely. This has been done, for example, in some early paper, in 2000. I think there are some papers addressing exactly that. They checked that they assumed some violation, for example, of the collective nature of the interaction, and they checked which kind of errors would have result at the logical level, and then they later they concatenated and they took care of those, if I remember correctly, by using a standard error correction technique. Yes. So you may have to use all the tricks all together in order to get something in.
So usually in say topological quantum computation, somebody will say, you know, errors normally occur locally. So what we really want to do is store information in sort of a global, in some global subspace, which is not going to be accessible to the errors. All of the examples we have for DFS today seem to be the opposite of that. We seem to assume some kind of global error and then store information in some local mod global kind of parameter. Is this just a property of ion paths? Is there a large class of systems where global errors are much more common than local errors? Or did I misunderstand what you did?
No. You understood perfectly. So in experimentally irrelevant systems, it seems okay. DFS, you may know that have been realized and demonstrated in the lab in many different systems. But I'm not excited about all of those because I think the most important example is still the ion trap. Because there, the collective noise was really the dominant source of noise that was bothering people. Okay. In the other experiments, or at least most of them, if I'm right, people were just simulating this collective thing, this collective noise, in order to demonstrate that indeed the DFS encoding could have helped in getting rid of most of the noise. Okay. So collective noise is certainly out there, and ion trap is one of the most important. It's still one of the most important implementation proposals we have. So if DFS would be able just to take care of that, I think would be still, a pretty good thing. But On the other hand, I don't think I really agree with what you said. I mean, being correct, I agree and disagree at the same time. Look, so the part which I agree is the one I just wrote. It seems it's just I attract in the real. Don't let me realize that. But if I, even topological, the idea behind the topological quantum computing and DFS is pretty much the same. Okay, so you know that basically you have to find some virtual subsystem, okay, some factor that is decoupled. The property, the symmetry property of the noise, okay, in this case gives you the right algebra, that is the algebra of the totally symmetric operators, and then you have this virtual decomposition of your space, and you're gonna put information in one of the safe centers. One is topological quantum computing, the random algebra is going to give by the local, the quasi-local algebra of local errors, and the global quantums, like in the Kitaev model, wrapped in a torus topology, you have the strings with non-trivial homology going around the cycles of the torus. Those are the responsible of the noiseless part, while the local operators are responsible for the errors. So in this sense, I think the mechanism behind, regardless, I mean, the details, the fact, is the local, yes, no local we have to look at is more at this more abstract algebra level rather than in the spatial level involved when you look in the qubit. For example,
so I understand that. What I'm more asking you is, are there examples of, I mean, a priori, it doesn't have to be the DFS only deal with global.
I understand. So you're asking me whether there are other
for local errors.
Okay, we can cook several other examples. As far as I know, the collective one is still not just the prototypical, but it's still the only really important here. But topological quantum computing, I would regard an instance of noiseless subsystem as well. Actually, I wrote a paper with Seth White that has been either published, so showing, it's crazy, but PRL, it was amazing. No, I couldn't believe. And I was never able to see the referee reports. Okay, the only thing I had from the PRL was, please send us the copyright transfer. So they thought the paper was so good or so bad. Anyway, so we had a paper, jokes apart, we had a paper where we tried to argue that those topological quantum computing and the DFS in this more advanced formulation that is neither subsystem are pretty much the same. So in this respect, I think they are. If you like, what I'm trying to say here is not just collecting the coherent, it's even topological quantum computing an instance of this general schema. You may want to disagree on this. Yes. Okay, thank you for the question.
These ion traps, which seem to be the most promising one so far, what is the next energy level? So how long would you have to wait to do one gate? The radiometricity condition. What's the time scale associated with that?
I don't have to figure out that. It's reasonable. What I know that
it's reasonable, yeah.
But if I know even where to look at the record, we might check it together later. I think it's order of microseconds, but I'm not sure. You can easily compute in terms of the known parameters defining the levels in the high. Yes. Yeah. Rather,
I'm wondering if there's any applications people find for holonomic gates besides quantum computations as another quantum technology. Like the decoherence free subspaces and subsystems have applications in communication, cryptography. And so what about the holonomies? Is there some other application?
No, as far as I know, I don't know that. You know, again, even topological quantum computing, okay, the nature of the connections that are generating the anomalies is different, it's more topological, okay? So even in topological quantum computing, basically is a sort of anomaly processing. Okay, right? Do you agree on this? Okay, so you're dragging quasi particles from each other, and they will pick up some abelian or non-abelian phase depending you are, I don't know, in a nu 1 over 3 or nu 5 over 2 all liquid. So, but this is still quantum computing. but if you like, a lot of, of course, I didn't certainly invent them. They were invented by the non-Abelian analogies. They were invented by the Dolchik Z and Hilchik and Frank Dolchik and Z. And so they certainly have application in more standard physical setups. Though I'm not aware of any experimental realization of a non-Abelian analogy, say, in high energy physics or so. And indeed, let me put that even this stuff is not going to be, is not going to provide a final answer for fault tolerant quantum computing. It will certainly provide, for example, if you would realize any of these things, of the things I showed you today in the lab, that would be, as far as I, to the best of my knowledge, that would be the first, one of, certainly one of the first experimental realization of ever of the non-Abelian quantum holonomies in the lab. So it might be regarded as having a more general interest just as a quantum phenomenon. So non-Abelian holonomies themselves are still, I think, open to experimental investigations. And here we may even make use of them. So you would catch two birds with a stone.
Don't they occur in some sense in molecular spectrum? I mean, it's not under the control of the experimenter.
Exactly. But those are Abelian. I think.
Certainly
Abelian. Yeah, indeed. Absolutely. Very phases that were first introduced in the molecular, where the control parameters were the zero parameters and the nuclei configuration.
They were known in some sense. It's really the Born Oppenheimer approximation, but it's a better way of thinking about
the Born Oppenheimer. One of the first papers by Mead, it was a chemist, and they were like this diabolical points, and they had all these kind of things. Yes, so maybe observe, but as a Raphael stress, not in a control question. I mean, this is what is happening out there, and you just describe everything in terms of this thing. Here, you would like to, as we quantum computing engineers, we would like to do all the time. We want to drive system on some part of the control space we want. Okay, so we want engineer system showing this in a controlled fashion. Yes, but probably molecular physics, even non-Abelian stuff, showed up.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some, they affect the rate of some chemical reactions that you get in one product instead of another because basically of human interface.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so, okay,
I can tell you that the geometrical phases, they found a lot of applications in other fields, but they're already known
applications, so I can't stop that. It's not me. Any other question?
I think you said the noiseless subsystem, the dimension, did you say that as you increase the number of qubits, say n qubits, the dimension of the noiseless subsystem goes by n minus 1 or linearly?
That was the dark state planet. It's very bad. And of this guy at the bottom level,
right.
We got one, save, omega 1, omega 2, omega 3, omega n. Okay, so you can show basically you call this g1, g2, g3, and this is an excited state. Okay, so basically the endotonium of this guy here is h, I over n. Omega I, E, G I, plus the initial conjugate. Okay? So basically, you see that this guy here is really coupled with just one state in the bottom state.
It's probably about particular in terms of coupling.
No. Look, I don't know whether I'm answering to. You have just one state plus, let's call it proportional to. This state is the only one that is really coupled to this. Okay, you see, you can just take out in this. And so all the other n minus 1 orthogonal to this spent by the ground states are going to be 0 eigenvalue eigenstates in this. I say this is the dark state manifold. And this is true for whatever choice of the omegas you can do.
Okay, I think I understand.
Okay. Thank you.